we're assaulted by a barrage of assertions through all the media that liberty, equality and justice can only be served by the liberation of our society from all previous externally imposed constraints upon human identity, family and sexuality. And yet the goal, very self-evidently today, as we look at it, of this political philosophy that talks about liberty, talks about equality, talks about justice, is not liberty, but power.
That's an excerpt from a speech entitled Sexuality, Politics, and Culture. The full speech is coming up later. On the news portion this week, the federal government introduces a new prostitution law. Quebec's National Assembly approves Canada's first euthanasia bill. And a follow-up to an interview we did a few months ago on the need for a national palliative care strategy. The idea has taken a huge step forward in Parliament.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
A big win for ARPA's lobbying efforts in Ottawa on the need for a new law to regulate prostitution in Canada. You'll recall that late last year, the Supreme Court struck down the old law, saying that the way it was written and enforced put the lives and safety of prostitutes at risk. The High Court gave the government a year to write a new law, and Justice Minister Peter McKay introduced the new draft of the bill earlier this month. ARPA lawyer Andre Schutten says there's a fundamental difference between the old law and the new one.
So the old criminal code had said, you know, you can't solicit, you can't live off the avails, and you can't operate a body house, but the actual exchange of sex for money, or money for sex, was legal. And so what they've done with this new law is they've shifted the criminal focus away from the prostitute and towards the pimps and the johns, those people who would take advantage of children, who would take advantage of young women, who would exploit them and use them for their own pleasure. And by doing that, what they've done is they've said it is now illegal to purchase sex. That's where the focus is. And so now that exchange of sex for money is illegal, but the focus is on the purchaser, the buyer, the pimps and the johns. It's not focused on those who have been historically exploited by this sex trade.
Critics of the new law are already threatening a legal challenge, though. They say the new legislation doesn't really change anything, that it still doesn't fix the original problem, the lack of security of the person for those in the sex trade. But Andre Schutten says there's a reason for that.
No matter which avenue you take, through the Nordic model, through the old Canadian model, through the American model, which bans everything, none of those laws are going to be perfect. None of them are going to protect everybody completely. The reason being that prostitution is, and this is where our critics don't seem to get it, prostitution is inherently dangerous. There is nothing safe about it to begin with.
The new bill likely won't clear Parliament and the Senate till late this year. In the meantime, you can write your MP to support the legislation. Just use the easy mail feature on the ARPA website. Another new law was also introduced earlier this month, this one in the Quebec National Assembly, where the new Liberal government reintroduced a bill that had originally been written by the old PQ government, a bill that essentially legalizes euthanasia. Alex Schadenberg is with the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition.
This bill gives doctors the right to lethally inject their patients. So it's not about writing a prescription and people taking it themselves. It's actually about causing the death directly of another person. So this is normally seen under our criminal code as a form of homicide, but in this case, the Quebec government has decided to redefine euthanasia as a form of medical treatment. So that's a great concern to us because, of course, I don't think that giving somebody a lethal injection could ever be defined as a form of medical treatment.
Schadenberg says the new law is based on what's known as the Belgian model, and there's some big problems with that.
And the Belgian model of euthanasia has really become quite out of control in the last few years, where they now have euthanasia for people who are depressed. There's been several big cases of that. One case in particular is the case where Professor Tom Mortier found out about his mother's euthanasia death. She was 64. She was completely healthy, but she was going through depression from the fact that she had a relationship breakup with a man that had been in her life for many years. And after that, she wanted euthanasia, and they said that that was acceptable because of her psychological suffering. They also say that there'd be lots of safeguards, but the fact of it is they allow it for psychological suffering, which they did not define. And, of course, people going through depression and mental issues, which would be psychological suffering, are they actually competent to make a decision for themselves?
The coalition is already preparing the groundwork for a legal challenge to the new bill. Schadenberg says it'll be based, at least in part, on the notion that the criminal code provisions against homicide should supersede any attempt to legalize euthanasia as something dressed up as health care.
In the Netherlands, they legalized euthanasia in 2002, and how they did it was by creating an exception to homicide for certain circumstances. In Quebec, they've done it totally different, of course, because Quebec doesn't have control of the criminal code. So they said, well, we'll define it as medical treatment. This is obviously a jurisdictional question. And how it's always worked in Canada, now I have no idea where the courts are going to go today in 2014. Traditionally, it's always been seen that the federal law supersedes a provincial law when there is a conflict between the two.
More information on the bill, or if you'd like to donate to the Legal Challenge Fund, just go to the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition website. They're at epcc.ca. And one thing more, you may recall that back in April, our feature interview was with NDP Member of Parliament Charlie Angus. He was getting ready to put forward a motion to improve palliative and end-of-life care across the country. His motion has now passed Parliament with all-party support.
It centers palliative care on the needs of the family, spiritual, and community understanding of what palliative care is, so that we're saying this isn't just delivery of medical services. This is a delivery of a vision of how to do integrated healthcare that respects families and has them part of the discussion, because it's really not just about the patient, it's about the family more than anything at this point when we're dealing with end-of-life care.
Angus says it is only a motion, though, not a private member's bill, and that means it's approval in principle of the idea, nothing more. The challenge now, he says, will be to keep the pressure up to see this idea move forward.
Up till now, this has been non-existent discussion at the federal level, so we really need to engage civil society to push all our members apart to say, you guys voted for this, where is it, when are we going to actually see some concrete results?
Angus says the actual delivery of palliative care services is a provincial responsibility, but he'll be pressuring the federal government to help make that happen by including some financial commitments to the idea in upcoming budgets. That's it for the news portion of the program. Now we move to the feature part. And this week we have an edited version of a speech delivered to a fundraising dinner at the ARPA Niagara chapter. The speech is from Reverend Joe Boot of Toronto. He's closely associated with the Ezra Institute. They do Christian apologetics and worldview work, and the speech is on the issue of sexuality, politics, and culture. I should tell you that the full speech ran a whole hour. We've edited it down to about 30 minutes, but it's definitely worth a listen. If you want to hear the full hour-long version, I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the program. But here's Reverend Boot, recorded June 1st at the dinner held at the Heritage Christian School in Jordan, Ontario.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's great to be here this evening, and I want to thank ARPA for the kind invitation to have the opportunity to be part of this evening with you. And I'm addressing the challenging topic of sexuality in our culture today. I do want to note that I'm going to do so from a political and philosophical, but not a pastoral perspective. I am a pastor, but I'm not going to be addressing the issue of sexuality in our culture this evening as a pastor, but more from the cultural and political standpoint, which this evening is about. This is, after all, the Association of Reformed Political Action. And so I want to come at the topic this evening in terms of the political and philosophical ramifications that are facing us today. Now, the starting point for addressing issues such as this, in particular the decay and collapse of our culture in this area of human sexuality, has to begin with Scripture. Because that is the place we need to begin all of these considerations, including politics. I want to read to you from 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, words that will be familiar, I'm sure, to most of you. But understand this, that in the last days, there will come times of difficulty. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. If ever there was a summation of the cultural context in which we find ourselves, I think that is it. This is the kind of context in which we find ourselves today. So I want to begin by talking about the political foundations of the sexual revolution that we find ourselves in today. It's a kind of second installment from the one that my parents' generation began in the 1960s. Commenting on the life and thought of Nietzsche, G.K. Chesterton declared, and I quote, "The man who thinks without the proper first principles goes mad. Thinking in isolation and with pride ends in being an idiot. Every man who does not have a softening of the heart must at last have a softening of the brain." And I think G.K. Chesterton was to the point in noting that if we begin in the wrong place, we end with social, cultural, and political idiocy. Now, any Christian who is conversant with developments in our culture over the last 10 years in the area of human identity and sexuality cannot, I think, but see our social and political order as one that has lost its mind and gone insane, like Nietzsche himself in the dissolution of his own thought. Because with the foundational principles being false, the kind of folly that is on display today, that would say there are somewhere between 7 and perhaps even 50 gender identities, or that homosexual marriage is a question of justice, only that can result from false first principles. Now, the first basic factor in politics, for centuries actually in Christendom, was the first principle that man is a creature of God and made in his image. That was a first principle. Second principle was that all power and authority to have legitimacy must derive from God and his absolute sovereign authority. And as a result, the states of Europe, at least formally, and the United States, made their various appeals for legitimacy to God. Now, we may say that they didn't always get it right, that there were mistakes made in the history of Christian political thought in Europe, certainly. But they made their appeal to God. Modern political life, however, is no longer interested in the question of legitimizing authority. And the reason it no longer believes this is it does not believe morality and justice can be justified by an appeal beyond man. If you don't think that you can justify morality and the concept of justice by an appeal beyond man himself, you're not going to be concerned primarily with legitimization. Rather, the core political thought now is, I'm going to call it Nietzschean, in its concern with human will and with human power. And with Christianity dethroned and biblical morality being viewed as a socially constructed form of oppression, questions of public morality and justice no longer involve God. The church and transcendent authority are no longer consulted because these issues are now seen as matters not of theology, but of human psychology. And therefore, they are essentially political questions to be worked out in terms of the social contract. And that contract in our society is constantly evolving. People say, well, I've evolved. I changed my mind on this. And the social contract then changes as it moves, these issues move through the courts. And yet, at the same time, we can be fooled into a sense that not much has really changed because we hear so much about, and much continues to be made, of the concepts of freedom and liberty and equality. And those are usually words that mean something important to Christians. And we're assaulted by a barrage of assertions through all the media that liberty, equality, and justice can only be served by the liberation of our society from all previous externally imposed constraints upon human identity, family, and sexuality. And yet the goal, very self-evidently today, as we look at it, of this political philosophy that talks about liberty, talks about equality, talks about justice, is not liberty, but power. And the result, then, of championing the doctrine of liberal democracy, which marches onward in terms of equality, has been the effort in our time to destroy rival power centers to the state. And if we don't understand this, we cannot understand our contemporary situation. And what are the key rival power centers to the modern state are the church and the family. These are the spheres of sovereignty that have been swallowed by the state. Hierarchical and aristocratic institutions like the church and the family outside of the control of the state must be leveled to realize the egalitarian society of social justice. And social justice is the byword or the watchword that we hear today even in the church. But how are you going to bring about in a formerly Christian land? The only way to do that is to redefine morality and justice. The family and the church have been seen as preservers of morality and justice. Those to be leveled or set aside or destroyed requires the redefinition of morality and justice, where the church and the family become manifestations of oppression. So when you hear the word justice and you hear the term morality, you as a Christian are thinking about God and about law and about structure and about order and about moral obligation and about conscience. And modern political thought isn't interested in any of that. And then you wonder why you feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall. In an existentialist world, the state must become the organizing principle. It's the umbrella that is going to remake society, a society that has moved beyond good and evil in terms of God, in terms of justice, in terms of morality. It's gone beyond them. It's now defining all these things for itself. Now, it's at this point that we see the concern is not with legitimizing and justifying justice and morality, but with enforcing the will of the powerful. After all, how do you define real human interests if you've got no God? How do you define the greater good without God? And thus what initially masquerades as love and justice and liberal democracy and this all-inclusive egalitarian social order for everyone becomes the iron fist of arbitrary power. And this is critically relevant now to the issue of the sexual revolution and sexuality in our culture. In particular, the question of sodomy and the sexual revolution. And yes, I am going to use the word sodomy in reference to homosexuality, despite its political incorrectness in our time, because the word sodomy conveys moral action, not an ontological identity. And once you have adopted the terminology of queer, gay, and so forth, you've already actually been sold the bill of goods. There is no way we can understand the sexual revolution that has taken the West by storm without realizing then that reason, truth, and legitimacy don't matter in the pagan world. It's self-will, it's utility, it's power. And so what's happened is that human sexuality has become enmeshed with political rhetoric. That's why pastors don't want to deal with it. Because they're often told by their parishioners, well, you know, keep politics out of the pulpit. And if morality is made political, then every time you speak about public morality, you're being political. And then you're upsetting people and offending people. And most pastors don't want to do that. It affects the offering plate. Initially, we were told, weren't we? Many of you remember this. The power brokers told us that sexual choices were private and that a state has no place in the bedroom of the nation. Wasn't that Pierre Trudeau, if memory serves? And so homosexuals, we were told, should be left alone to indulge their sexual desires. They just want to have the right not to have their conduct criminalized. That was the argument. But shortly thereafter, the homosexuals began to claim that they were victims of discrimination and wanted remedial legislation to rectify this injustice. This complaint actually proved the fact that there is a very public aspect to private sexual acts. So we were told it's just private. So we shouldn't criminalize purely private things. But then when they demanded public remedial legislation, it demonstrated and proved the public nature of human sexuality. They came out of the closet to insist that toleration of their private acts was not enough. Their behavior must be publicly vindicated and recognized as normal. And on the heels of that, all kinds of other practices. Now, since the homosexual activists have claimed the right to marry and adopt children and pass on inheritance to be considered spouse and next of kin and so forth, we have proof beyond all doubt that the homosexual is not simply concerned with the right to privacy, but they want public acceptance and support. And it's that that has engulfed Canada and all of the West today, and which we are now trying to export to Africa and Asia and anywhere else with threat of sanctions and cutting aid and so on if the rest of the world does not comply. It's been proven then that what has engulfed our nation is a belief that the state has every right in the bedroom, has an investment, which Christians have understood anyway, in the bedroom by endorsing and privileging various sexual practices. So what Trudeau said, beginning this transition, has been proven utterly and completely false by the very activists who have overturned our social order. No one claims the right to do something they want to be kept private and concealed. That's the whole point of keeping it private and concealed. You don't say, I want everybody to know it's my right. Keeping a homosexual lifestyle truly private in the clandestine sense was an acquiescence to society's implied judgment that that behavior was wrong. Today, the homosexual and increasingly representatives of other sexual predilections advance their cause then on the grounds of rights and moral principle. They refuse to accept the judgment that their actions are wrong, and they do so because, as I've explained, of the existential character of our age. They insist, therefore, on the reversal of this public judgment. And this means a legal recognition that obliges everyone to recognize the legitimacy of their act. And so they require that society affirms sodomy as morally equivalent to the marital act. The ultimate objective moves well beyond the desire for this to be legal. Rather, as Paula Ekelbrick, former legal director of the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, has stated, she says this, quote, being queer pushes the parameters of sex, sexuality, and family, and transforming the very fabric of society. We must keep our eyes on the goals of providing true alternatives to marriage and of radically reordering society's view of reality. That's the goal. It wasn't about letting a few people do in private what they wanted to do without it being criminal. This explains the revolutionary desire for legal and political redress. What it doesn't do is provide the motive for why the revolution is pursued in the name of justice and morality today. How? Why is it pursued in the name of justice and morality? Now, for that, you need a theological explanation. This is why theology is relevant to politics. The contemporary sexual revolutionary, you see, is a walking contradiction. For although modern man claims there is no legitimizing of justice or morality beyond the criteria of human interest, he behaves with moral outrage towards those who would differ from his chosen lifestyle. Outrage. They claim there's no legitimizing any principle of justice beyond a human criteria, but then behaves with moral outrage towards anyone who would differ from that chosen lifestyle. Yet on their own premises of liberalism, other people have every right to an existential private interpretation of morality. So why can there be no toleration of disapproval? The biblical explanation for the intolerance, anger, and rage that accompanies the homosexual activists and other sexual revolutionaries lies in the theological reality of sin and guilt and its fruit in human behavior. Sin, you see, always produces in human beings, from a Christian perspective, moral rebuke. in somebody who has a functioning conscience. Since man, whatever his denials, is a creature of God, we cannot escape this moral rebuke. It's always there. This rebuke and condemnation, when it is left unaddressed by Christ's atonement for sin, which deals with the problem of sin and guilt. If you don't have Christ and you don't have his atonement, it leads to a chronic problem of guilt. So much so that many modern psychiatrists have said that guilt is the cornerstone of all neuroses. Chronic guilt leads to powerlessness and all manner of sadistic and masochistic efforts to cover our sin. Now, to live in perpetual vice, where you've defined yourself by your vice, cannot be tolerated. You cannot live with that without a powerful rationalization to justify it. You have to be able to justify a perpetual lifestyle of vice. The requirement is that sin and vice, therefore, be turned into the good. And the real moral order is to be replaced with something compatible with the activity we're trying to excuse. And don't we all know, even as Christians, how this operates in our own Christian life? How when we're in the grip of a habitual issue of sin, we start to find justifications and excuses for it. Why should the non-believer be any different? That's the nature of rationalization. God's woe is pronounced on this age-old transgression. The prophet Isaiah says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil." Such people no longer seek to conform themselves to God's order by becoming just. They try and justify themselves by arguing that bad is good. When this activity is persisted in, rationalization eventually perverts our ability to reason, and reality is completely inverted. And so for many of these people who argue for this position, reality has already become inverted. What, for example, could be more absurd than arguing that justice requires the legalization of same-sex marriage, as if there were such a thing? The same logic argues that abortion is a positive good and a loving choice. If murder is love, then indeed death is life. Good is evil is good, black is white is black. The progressive acceptance of sexual misbehavior reinforces and emboldens others to come forth making exactly the same claim. Hence the growing chorus of intellectuals defending bestiality and pedophilia in our society. The rationalization of sin becomes the engine of revolutionary change in the whole of society. And this is a point that Robert Riley has struck on, I think, very tellingly. He says this, and I quote, "If you are going to center your public life on the private act of sodomy, you had better transform sodomy into a highly moral act. If sodomy is a moral disorder, it cannot be legitimately advanced on the legal or civil level. On the other hand, if it is highly moral, if it's a highly moral act, it must serve as the basis for marriage, family and adoption, and community. As a moral act, sodomy should be normative. If it is normative, it should be taught in schools as a standard. If it is a standard, it should be enforced. In fact, it should be hieratic. Active homosexuals should be ordained as priests and bishops. Sodomy should be sacramentalized." And there can be no holdouts like ARPA or TWU or the CLF, Christian Legal Fellowship. There can be no holdouts because they pose the threat of a potential rebuke. We must all say that evil is good for the rationalization to be secure. And it's this rationalization that drives what has been called the culture war. Everybody is to celebrate the new morality, or you are evil, you're a homophobe, you're mentally ill. You're an oppressor. It is for this reason that the truth is unimportant, even in the legal sphere in Canada, as a defense against charges of hate speech when it comes to the issue of homosexuality. You are aware of that. That the truth of your statement is no defense. Truth is irrelevant because truth is what the political elite declares it to be for the time in terms of the current social contract. This revolution requires then the tools of compulsion to enforce the acceptance of this, Self-justification requires the complicity of everyone in the culture. That's why organizations, Christian organizations, churches, institutions, schools are not being left alone on this. It requires the complicity of the whole culture to accept the rationalization. What's the nature of the rationalization? It's based on the idea that the sexually immoral are victims of circumstance, of nature, and now of prejudice and oppression. They're not sinners. And so the self-hatred that these people can feel, and I know this as a pastor, having dealt with many different people over my 20 years of ministry now, their loathing of themselves, the anger and guilt that a person's conscience produces in instances of perpetual sexual perversion is redirected towards society. That anger is redirected. And it's redirected especially to those institutions that rebuke the sin of homosexuality and refuse to accept the rationalization, especially the family, which is a living, breathing rebuke to the idea of homosexuality, and the church, which is meant to preach prophetically about morality. These institutions are said to victimize and oppress and are to be coerced into the new way of thinking in the name of social justice. Friends, we are at the end of that long march through our institutions, not the beginning. This isn't a warning lecture tonight. This is a post-mortem. Most of the church wasn't listening. Most of the church in the Western world has been asleep on these issues since the 1940s. In the final analysis, though, brothers and sisters, I end on this positive note, because you're all looking so happy. The lie cannot stand, because it is a lie. It is the lie of Romans 1 and 2. Because we are, in fact, creatures made in God's image, living in God's world. And that's inescapable. Only recognition and acceptance of what man is as created by God can lead to a social order that has any future. Our social order right now has no future, and we should be happy about that. Man's relative ideas, you see, presuppose that which is absolute. You can only have a meaningful conception of what is relative alongside that which is absolute. If the good and the justice is relative to itself, then it can mean anything. And it's not truly relative. It's become absolute for the moment. Man is totally relative. I can tell you this. All truth is relative to God. It's related back to God. When God and his creation then is denied, justice and morality are reduced to whatever is world, which inescapably becomes the will of the powerful, giving us, as I began, the politics of power. In such a world, liberty and equality before the law are irrelevant. And I've been told as much. Where God's creational purposes are denied, libertinism in the name of freedom is the foundation of tyranny. The denial of God is the enthronement of man's will and illegitimate power. But like all sin, man's rebellion in the social order leads to one end, death and ruin. The humanist today has no future. He doesn't believe in the family. He doesn't believe in life. Homosexuality as a lifestyle is a culture of death, because there is no procreation. There is no future. In such a context, the words of Proverbs 8:36 are important concerning the wisdom of God. The Bible says, all who sin against me wrong their own souls. All those who hate me love death. You see, God does not want the state to become a power state expressing man's alleged freedom from God. It is to be God's minister. That's why ARPA exists. To remind the state that it is a minister, according to Romans 13, it is God's diaconate. It is his servant. When it ceases to be such, it is a tyranny. All true power and legitimacy and authority come from God. Only his power and authority is non-disintegrating. And all things are therefore to be brought under the government of God in all spheres. They're to be placed under him, and that's our task. That's your task and mine. And we, if we are people who live in terms of the word of God, we are the only people on the face of the earth who have a future. So don't think this is the end. This is the turning of a page to a new beginning. Whatever the covenantal judgments we are under in these days of rebellion in our culture are, we must welcome them and thank God for his faithfulness to discipline us. Everything that can be shaken will be shaken, so that only that which cannot be shaken will remain. And the road to recovery, brothers and sisters, begins with us and the doctrine of God's sovereignty. This is our first principle that keeps us from a descent into idiocy. We must reaffirm the total sovereignty of God in all its implications for every area of life and affirm without equivocation his total power and government in defining and predestinating all things. Created to move in terms of his sovereign purpose, it's in this faith that we as Christians, as believers, have meaning, hope, and a future. In fact, it's the only viable future for man and his politics, because what we face today is the end, the burning out of man. It's the exhaustion of man with his utopian schemes to rebuild society without God. And so we are to commit ourselves to the sovereign Lord and seek his kingdom and his righteousness in our lives before all else, and apply his sovereignty and his word in our families, in our school, in church and community, and model the Christian life of faith to a watching world, and take up the mandate to be his prophets and priests in our culture today, because this alone is true freedom. And if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Thank you for your time.
Once again, that was a shortened version of the speech. If you'd like to hear the full hour-long speech, which cites a lot more philosophers and digs much further into the foundational thinking on this issue, go to EzraInstitute.ca and click on Teaching Lectures. You'll find the full version there.
This has been Lighthouse News, shining the light of biblical truth on today's current events. Production Manager Mark Peninga, Technical Director Nate Bosher. Questions or feedback, email info@arpacandidate.ca. Be sure to join us again in 2 weeks for another edition of Lighthouse News.